Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America: The First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts, just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
44 minutes in, and we're back with, we're finishing up in Brooklyn, and we're heading for deep in the heart of Germany. Hal, pick us up on where we're going in this big world-spanning minute.
All right, minute 44. On the Brooklyn dock, Steve Rogers stands motionless, his gaze fixed on his newly scuppled arms, the weight of his super soldier transformation sinking in, his mind grappling with the power now coursing through him. Far across the ocean at Hydra headquarters, disciplined Hydra troops march through a dimly lit hallway, their boots echoing in unison. Johann Schmidt strides purposely toward his laboratory, flanked by two Wehrmacht officers and a stern Waffen-SS officer. Their faces are taut with impatience. One Wehrmacht officer pauses, eyeing a Hydra guard in a sleek black uniform, his face obscured by a helmet and mask, the non-standard gear drawing a puzzled glance. The Waffen-SS officer's voice cuts sharply. "The Führer is not accustomed to being ignored, Herr Schmidt. He funds your research because you promised him weapons." The first Wehrmacht officer adds, his tone cold. "You serve at his pleasure. He gave you this facility as a reward for your injuries." Schmidt frowns. "Reward? Call it what it is. Exile. I am no longer reflect his image of Aryan perfection." The second Wehrmacht officer steps closer, his voice rising. "You think this is about appearances? Your Hydra division has failed to deliver so much as a rifle in over a year. And we had learned through local intelligence you had mounted a full-scale incursion into Norway." The Waffen-SS officer's eyes narrow. "The Führer feels, how does he put it? The Red Skull has been indulged long enough." Schmidt, unfazed, gestures towards the laboratory door. "Gentlemen, you have come to see the results of our work."
Lovely job, Hal.
Yeah, and boy,
they're going to see.
Yeah, they're going to see. All right,
yes, big time. Results. Yes, yeah. The I keep thinking about these Hydra, the Hydra guys wearing those uniforms and their stiff walk. They're like incredibly. They're almost like robotic, and they remind me of the crew on the Black Hole, Disney's Black Hole.
Oh,
that
wow!
Stiff
yeah.
Goose march. That, and I remember. I saw this with my friend's kid brother, and he was absolutely terrified by those guys. And it's like, you know, that was like the dark phase of Disney. And I know this is a Paramount film, but it says just those dark 70s Disney vibes to it.
Oh, well, they've absolutely. Obviously got a Star Wars Stormtrooper vibe to them, too. I mean,
yeah, oh, for sure. You know,
so something that had popped into my mind early on, Brian, you had mentioned before we started about maybe circling back to the end of the Brooklyn scene real quick.
Well, I appreciate that. As in preparation for this episode, I was watching other minutes. In minute 42, I was absent. I was on assignment. But one of my favorite Easter eggs of all time in the whole Marvel Universe takes place in this episode. It's when Steve Rogers is running, chasing the saboteur, and he picks up the cab, the Lucky Star cab door to shield himself. And when he does that, there's a quick fraction of a second image of the public around panicking and a woman standing by a bus taking his picture. She's got a camera to her face. She's taking a picture of him doing that. In episode one of Falcon and the Winter Soldier, James Rhodes and Sam Wilson, War Machine and the Falcon, are standing in this memorial to Steve Rogers, whom the world, I guess, assumes is dead or retired or something. They don't know what really happened to him. But in this memorial is that photo that woman took of Steve holding the Lucky Star cab company door. And I just love that continuity, that, you know, the idea that 70 years later, somebody found this woman's picture that she took that day. Maybe it was published in the local newspaper. I don't know. But it showed up at the Smithsonian Institution, you know, decades later. And I just think that's just delightful. So let's carry on with minute 44. But I couldn't let that minute pass in my absence without pointing out that Easter egg.
And to think that Joe Johnston hung that rifle over the fireplace so many years before that is astonishing. Right.
So I mean, you have to wonder how that happened. Did someone from Marvel say, make sure there's somebody taking a picture in that scene? How did that happen? It's incredible.
Hopefully it's brilliant foresight.
Right.
Or it could be dumb luck. Who knows? Somebody's watching the movie. I mean, look at where Star Wars Rogue One came from. And, you know, it's just somebody rereading the crawl.
Right. John Knoll, in fact.
Yeah. Exactly. But it's, you know, the thing that always strikes me about this is kind of the introduction. Well, this will be the introduction to Hydra that we're going to start seeing the width and breadth of Hydra here. But it's like the Nazis aren't evil enough.
Right.
We actually had to replace the Waffen SS.
Yeah. To SS and a half.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. The SSS, yeah.
Yeah, the SSS. Until you chop off a head, and then there's, you know, two more S's.
Yeah,
But, you know, along those lines, something that I'm wondering about, and I don't know if it's really explained in the film. If it is, I'm kind of drawing a blank. So maybe I'm looking to Brian for the comic book side of things. So at this point, the officers with Schmidt. The non-Hydra guys are refer to him as Red Skull, mm-hmm. quoting Hitler. You know, the Red Skull has been indulged long enough. Do they know what he really looks like? Do they think that's just sort of a nickname inside things? Like, how many people know that what we're seeing here with Hugo Weaving is just makeup, and the Red Skull is underneath?
Well, in the comics, to the best of my recollection, he almost never wore a rubber mask. He was always just the Red Skull. And he walked around being the Red Skull and horrific, and everybody recoiled from his appearance. I'm sure there were times in, you know, future in the 70s, 80s, 90s when maybe he disguised himself. But as far as I can recall, from his creation in the 40s through the 50s and 60s, he was just the Red Skull. And he just looked like that.
That's It's interesting to me, because obviously here he's, you know, he's got the makeup or the mask on, you know, for a reason. And it's not to skull shame, but it would be hard to keep a low profile, you know, walking around
the corridors. Which one of you is a Red Skull? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a very practical reason too, that one doesn't want to waste Hugo Weaving, you know.
Yeah. there is that.
I mean, there's a reason all the superheroes end up ripping their masks off at some point during the fight, which never happens in the comics either.
That's a great point.
Hey, that's Tobey Maguire. Okay, let's go.
If you've got Hugo Weaving, use him. That's lesson as any.
But you spark an interesting note I took, which is the Red Skull's quote that I no longer reflect Hitler's vision of Aryan perfection. And I think that provides an interesting motive for him. It suggests to me that maybe before he became the Red Skull, Johann Schmidt was quite content to just be a good Nazi super scientist. I think it says something about Schmidt's self-regard of himself after his accident. And one wonders if Hitler really has a problem with him being the Red Skull, but Schmidt thinks Hitler does. So it's an interesting character insight that maybe gives Schmidt a credible reason for going rogue.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, his personality is Gilmore Hodge. I mean, he's the German Gilmore Hodge. I think he's got this superior ambition. I don't know where he fits in with Toby Jones. Like, were they co-workers, or was he in charge of the project, or was he brought in later? But he does have that, you know, that superior aggressive ambition that seems to drive him.
Right. I always get the impression that while Schmidt and Zola are both brilliant scientists, Zola's smarter. Zola's got the genius to actually build these things that Schmidt envisions. That's the way I read their relationship.
And the restraint too. I mean, he's Erskine basically. He filled in the blank when Erskine left.
Yeah,
and right. I think, you know, his biggest strength is he knows when to shut up. You know, I mean, he's going to get a steak and potatoes in a future episode, but he's, he knows that's not, that doesn't worry. He's doing the long game. And
right. But he's also, he's not a leader. He's not,
no,
you know, he's the, I think whether he would admit it or not, he's sort of the pet scientist. He's not someone who's going to be running this project on his own for his own ends. He's doing the science for the people that are, in some sense, allowing him to do it.
Yeah, but I think that's the key insight. Schmidt's the leader, Zola's the follower.
And Zola also, I mean, Zola pictures Red Skull as being front of the plank. You know, it's like he can keep doing all of his work and draw all the fire. You know, Zola can just, you know, plod away at this, at whatever he wants to do. And he doesn't seem to be a threat to anyone because he's just one of the background, you know, he'd be a walk-on extra. Even though he's kind of the smarts behind it, Zola's the one that created all these things for Schmidt. He created the plane and the car and the rocket with the propeller on. You know, all those things are Zola inventions, not Schmidt inventions.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I think Zola knows if something happened to Schmidt, he'd be just fine. Hitler would just bring him on and say, "Okay, build me some stuff," and Zola would be happy to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. He's not in the line of fire. So.
I had a thought about another bit of this discussion where Schmidt is criticized for mounting a full-scale incursion into Norway. And, you know, I did a little reading up on that. And in our world, keeping in mind that our world is not necessarily the Marvel Cinematic Universe, the Nazis invaded Norway in April 1940 and had conquered it by June. And the Germans occupied it through the end of the war. So it seems odd to me that the Red Skull taking a little expedition into territory already under German control would be a big deal. I mean, I don't quite know why they're using that as a cudgel against him.
That's a really interesting point. And I kind of wondered if it was just, if it wasn't so much as, you know, Germans shouldn't be invading this country, shouldn't make this incursion, or if it was just more of, your unit is small and secret and narrowly focused, and you have no business sort of going out into the world and trying to do things that are unauthorized.
Yeah. And remember also that it wasn't like if Norway's already been conquered, I mean, Quisling and all that, you know, they have a puppet government installed and everything going on. And all of a sudden one of Hitler's lieutenants is out there driving a tank through a church and killing random villagers or killing a whole town. You know, he's playing with stuff that they've already suppressed. They haven't been having to worry about Norway. And all of a sudden he's causing all this stuff going on. You know,
it makes a lot of sense to me. He's literally a loose cannon.
Yeah.
Yeah, quite. Absolutely. Yeah. That's exactly right.
That makes sense to me. Okay. Well, I rest my case. I rest my point.
There you go. No,
point well taken.
Now I have two questions about this. Schmidt, is Schmidt already, or does he already have the next minute planned out?
I think the answer to that question depends on whether he knew what they were coming to talk to him about. If he had an inkling that they were coming to criticize him or shut him down or demand results. I don't know. They can always demand results, but I don't know. What do you think?
I think he probably did. I mean, this whole thing, just cinematically, and this is one of those nice instances where the minute breaks the scene quite nicely. You know, just we see Schmidt at the very end. You know, you have come to see this, and we know what's coming next time. But to me, everything about this, just from a storytelling perspective, feels like these guys are walking into a trap.
Sure,
and that's more visceral than anything else. But you know, the moment with the SS officer looking at the Hydra guard and his gear and helmet and face mask and things, which number one, that's powerful because everybody in the world would be terrified to be stared at by an SS officer at this point in history. And it doesn't faze the guard, and the SS guy is kind of put off by it, or SS or regular Wehrmacht. Whichever they're, you know, just sort of put off by it. But looking at the Hydra imagery along the walls, it just, everything says to me, you know, these guys are coming to see something that is maybe further off the rails than they would have expected.
Yeah, there's no swastikas in the hallways. There's no flags hanging anywhere. It's all hydro iconography.
Yeah.
So
hydro stuff, and then that altered sort of Nazi eagle with the crest, but as you said, has a hydra symbol in the base instead of a swastika. And just everything about it says, you know, we're already beyond any kind of, you know, reconciliation of sort of a misunderstanding and getting things realigned. It feels like the die is cast.
I think you're right. I think it's very foreboding for those Nazis as they're walking down that hallway of, this is not what we expected. But it raises, your question raises to me kind of the Goldfinger question of, why did Goldfinger gather all the bad guys to tell him his secret plan if he was just going to kill them anyway?
Well, I think there was an ancestor of my favorite character in Austin Powers, and that was, of course, Sir Basil Exposition. I think you needed. I mean, I wondered that even as a kid, and that's one of my all-time favorite movies. It's like, wouldn't it have been easier to just, and then the trash compactor, the car thing, probably could have just shot him, and that would have been fine. But that doesn't. That's not good cinema.
Not stylish.
I mean, you have to skip over the whole, you know, that beautiful model of Fort Knox. I mean, that's what it's all about.
He built that model knowing he was going to kill those guys. But he's just I got to do it, man.
Hey, Goldfinger, what's with that trick pool table? one of my favorite lines. But on the other hand, too, I mean, not that this is the Goldfinger minute, but Goldfinger was. He was an absolute showman. He was ostentatious, and he had a big sense of theatricality. And you see that in the in the book as well as in the picture. And, you know, I guess, hey, that doesn't make sense. But are we saying that your plan to, you know, break in and irradiate all the gold in Fort Knox, so your gold is worth more? Does that make sense? Well, I guess it makes more sense than telling everybody your plan so you can kill them.
I had an insight, and that may be too strong a word. I had a thought about an inkling about the first 5 seconds of this minute, where we see Steve on the dock kind of looking at his powerful arms and taking in the wonder his body has become. And the thought was this, that at this point, he's been Captain America for maybe 5 minutes, and he's a bull in a china shop. He's smashing through the plate glass windows, and he hasn't learned how to control this body. He's just beginning to understand his power. And some people have noted that in subsequent movies, future movies going throughout the Marvel Comics universe, Captain America seems to get stronger and more capable. He's, you know, we see him, for example, later in this movie, struggling to jump a gap that's maybe 20 feet. And later on, we'll see him leaping much farther than that and lifting things much heavier than the motorcycle he struggles to lift in this movie, kind of thing. And I think what we're, the way people explain that or retcon it, or as they say, at this point in Steve's life, he's got all the raw talent he needs. He's got the physical machine, but he doesn't know how to use it yet. So he's going to gain experience. He's going to gain training so that by the time something like Winter Soldier or Civil War comes around, he's a finely honed fighting machine that he is not yet in this movie.
Yeah. This is his basic training, basically, for being how to be a superhero.
Yeah, exactly.
And he just doesn't have those skills and experience yet.
Right. And there is something sort of plausible about the idea that, you know, if you step into the metal box and then you come out, you know, a foot taller and all ripped and everything else, that doesn't automatically mean you know how to use this instrument that you've been given. I think, I mean, just imagine the awkwardness if you took a nap and you woke up a foot taller.
Yeah.
And I mean, you'd be banging your head on things and, you know, you do weird things getting out of the car. You just have all that sort of muscle memory. So I think you extrapolate that out. These new abilities and just a new shape and size. I think it's reasonable that there's a learning curve and there's an adaptation period.
We never see it in the movies, but Steve Rogers has to have gone through and taken, you know, boxing classes and judo classes and karate classes and, you know, and fought through World War II, which was no small potatoes. And so the Steve Rogers we see in future movies is a far different cry from the one we get in this one, I think.
Right. Yeah. Well, we talked a little bit about, sorry, Jim.
No, go ahead.
We've talked a little bit about, okay, the super soldier serum. It's, you know, it's obvious it has some sort of effect on intellectual capacity or reflexes or something and things. But, you know, the thing I always wonder about is, did he study a little bit of physics along the way to learn how to throw the shield and bounce it off of 16 things and take out three bad guys before it comes back to him?
It, tough question, because the shield is basically magical. It's more or less Mjolnir, you know, that does exactly what he wants to do and no more, no less. I don't know. I just always kind of took it as that the mystical bonding between a man and his tool, like Excalibur or Mjolnir or something like that, you know, beggars description. But
yeah, and it's something that, you know, with his enhanced reflexes that he can, you know, he can do the pool shots, the billiard maneuvers of his shield. So I think that's probably one of the most natural things to him.
Right.
And I do have a question. I mean, there are so many, for lack of a better term, Hitler adjacent comics and fiction stories. I mean, we've got Indiana Jones, we've got the Rocketeer, we've got Captain America, even Doc Savage. In your head canon, are they all in the same place? Are they in the same universe? Is this all happening? While this is going on, is the Rocketeer somewhere off fighting? Indiana Jones busy with the OSS?
Well, we talked about this a little bit when we had Billy Campbell on one of our earliest episodes, and we all agreed, I think, that Indiana Jones and the Rocketeer are in the same universe. I don't think Captain America and all these superheroes are in that universe. But that's just my opinion.
What's interesting for me is the fact that they're set in, you know, in World War II. They're set in before and leading up to and against that backdrop of real world events. It's easy for me to imagine that they are all in the same universe. Now it's you wonder why, you know, Cliff Secord isn't making some reference to Superman or something like that, but since we didn't have Captain America quite yet when he was active, but and I think I did mention this on the other episode, and once again I don't have the artist name at my fingertips, but I've got this beautiful poster of painted, illustrated sort of what if movie poster, and it's something Commandos, and it's Indy and Captain America and the Rocketeer all going into battle together, and, you know, punching the Nazis and all the good things that we feel like. So maybe it's nothing more than just wishful thinking on my part, but we did establish before, you know, that we think that Indiana Jones and the Rocketeer could be in the same universe, because Disney suggests that with their things at Disney Springs.
Well, right. There's a little crossover.
That's the crossover there, Jock Lindsay's bar and Southseas Club thing. And the idea that Jock Lindsay, his pilot, was a barnstormer at the Bigelow Air Circus. And
I think that's just canon.
It's all in the same. Yeah, it's all in the same IP. I mean, even I think
it's all part of the show, folks. I think, it's all part of the show.
I think Disney also owns the Phantom, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah,
somehow wound up in there. So the Ghost Who Walks is also part of all of this. And you could have. I mean, I don't need a Ready Player One. I don't need every IP mixing in with every other one.
Right.
But, you know, it's like it would be interesting to see minuscule crossovers. I mean, we're getting this summer, as we're recording this, we're going to be getting the X-Men showing up with the MCU now, and it's there's possibilities that haven't been played out yet, and that can be a little bit overdone. Well, it's been overdone in the past, but I don't know. I don't know how much. To me, Crisis on Infinite Earths, and I know we're going to get into, you know, we're going to go way up into the backwaters, but I think Crisis on Infinite Earths kind of showed you can do it once, but doing it again and again and again just kind of wrecks everything, because you don't have, you can't, you don't have an end. You don't have a finale, because the finale doesn't really mean anything, because there's other people. There's Flash with the, you know, there's Flash with the bag over his head, and then there's Flash with the FTD florist Mercury on his head. You know, it wears thin after a while.
You've opened a real can of worms, Jim, because I'm among the comics fans, and perhaps it's a marker of my age that I didn't think Crisis on Infinite Earths was a good idea either. I just don't like these universe spanning, everybody dies and is brought back to life and the universe has crashed together. And then, oh, let's do it again 2 years from now, because right. that one didn't mean enough. And it's just ridiculous to me. And honestly, I'm really not a fan of where Marvel's gone with its whole multiverse, because, you know, why should I care about this Spider-Man if there's 50,000 other Spider-Men? That's just my take as a storyteller. I like my superheroes unique. I want to care about this Steve Rogers, not Steve Rogers of Universe 2742. And so that's where I'm coming from.
And when you lean too hard into that stuff, I mean, Brian, you hit it. You said, you know, at some point it just doesn't matter. And Jim, you said there's no ending to it. And it's because the stakes no longer matter.
Right.
You know, because exactly the reader says it's, you know, okay, well, this person dies. Well, that probably wasn't the real one. You know, there's another one somewhere else. And even if it was the real one, it says, you know, 2 years from now, we'll pick up another storyline and another line of comics, and it'll all be sort of undone anyway. But
well, you know, that's sort of the great tragedy of this. And I was struck by that by seeing the recent Deadpool movie that had the Human Torch in it. Our friend Chris Evans replayed his role as the Human Torch. Right. And it was played for laughs. And it was funny, but I took it as just a profound tragedy that the Human Torch we'd seen in those movies and grown to know and love and care about ended up in this horrific situation, in this right. wasteland in another dimension with no escape, ruled by a mad woman. It's just like, oh my God, that is so sad. I mean, yeah. you know, and I guess, spoiler alert, everything kind of almost worked out all right in the end, but it was just... I don't think the storytellers take this stuff seriously enough sometimes. They so right. want to have that arch moment or that fun or that sarcastic wink at the audience that they forget that they also are asking us to care about these characters. And sometimes those two conflict in a way that is really grating to me.
And the stakes get so high. I mean, I remember, you know, watching Superman, the TV series, it was always Superman versus bank robbers or Superman, right. you know, versus a kidnapper. And it's like, that was his big stakes with how is he going to save Lois? And it's like, okay, well, you know, that's fine. But I was watching, I may be one of the few people that actually watched Starfleet Academy, the latest Star Trek venture as we're recording.
I've watched it all.
And the final episode involved the entire entirety of Federation space had been surrounded by universe-killing mines that if one of them goes off, basically the universe dissolves, and there's 120 billion, you know, lives on all these different planets at right. stake. And then they, you know, they solve it in 5 minutes at the end and say, oh, well, all we have to do is hack this and, you know, type in this override passwords, and all, you know, all of a sudden they all go away. And it's like, well, there's no stakes. You don't really have to. How do you care about 120 billion people? You know, the end of the universe, basically.
Right.
And we're going to have to do it again next week, because if we want, you know, the next season, you're going to have to forget about the last time we tried to destroy the universe. And now the next, you know, let's bring in 600 starships and do this. And it's like you watch that and then you watch something like, you know, Khan versus Kirk. And it's just it's a battle yeah. between two ships. That is more compelling than saying, oh, by the way, the whole universe is going to blow up if we don't fix right. this part.
Well, and the whole Starfleet Academy, you know, continuity coming out of Discovery and the big leap forward and stuff after this burn, you know, at this point in Starfleet Academy, the Federation is sort of barely starting over. Yeah. So, you know, all due respect to 120 billion life forms, like if they wipe them out, it's like, oh, well, okay, the Federation just started over, 8 months ago. I guess we could start over again. And I'm exaggerating, but yeah, it was a great point, Jim. Plus the fact that at least the diagrams they showed, those mines were just in a ring.
Yeah.
And I've seen you remember space being at least three-dimensional.
Three-dimensional, yeah.
Yeah, wasn't that Khan's problem that he only yeah. had two-dimensional thinking? So anyway, yes.
Wow. Well, in exactly comics, right. there's been a little bit of a backlash to that universe-destroying storyline, because I think some creators got as tired of it as fans like me did. And so there's been a return to some of them doing very nice, intimate stories. And I think immediately of a Hawkeye series, limited series that came out in the comics several years ago. It's been a little while now, but it was basically just Hawkeye living in a basically a slum apartment and fighting Russian gangsters who were trying to take over the neighborhood. That was the comic.
Oh, wow.
And it was delightful. And it was so clever and witty. And it won all the awards and it deserved them. And that's the kind of story that people think you should be telling with a character like Spider-Man, who's just your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. He's not fighting aliens. He's your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. Daredevil does a lot of that on his comic and TV show. He's fighting, you know, Kingpin, who wants to take over New York City. Those are recognizable stakes. The universe is not at risk when we're seeing these heroes. So I think comics are flexible enough to tell both kinds of stories. I happen to enjoy and appreciate the ones that are maybe a little more relatable.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of the things that made like the first season in particular of The Mandalorian so compelling.
Yeah.
Because you had sort of an adventure of the week and the episode, I draw the blank on the name of it, but it was, you know, sort of the Mandalorian meets like the Magnificent Seven or, you know, the classic Western, you know, the stranger comes to town and they're being, you know, bedeviled by this, what to us in the big trilogy is this insignificant little AT-ST chicken walker thing. But in that one episode, you've got a village of people that don't really have much in the way of technology or armament, and they're being, you know, subjugated by this thing. That little chicken walker becomes terrifying, and it's the stakes are certainly high for this village. But yeah, it's not the universe. It's not part of some epic thing. And
you know what that village needed? It was some Ewoks.
Yeah. Could have used some
Ewoks. Good sized log. Yeah.
Right. Some short Wookiees.
Well, we've gone all over creation on this particular minute, which shows you just, you know, we can find things to talk about in an interstitial. We're getting in between set pieces.
I think the best minutes are like that.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Wow. Well, we've got more coming up. But I want to thank our audience for sticking with us. If you'd like to continue the conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. We do have the occasional guests. Be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.